Hi, all the Cloud Zendo folks, until we start talking. All right. Could somebody close the door in the back?
As soon as I walked away from closing the last pop-up window, we get another one.
What was that?
Are you taking care of the computer, so do you want to sit in this chair?
Yeah, that'd be great, thanks.
All right, so. Does anybody want the amplifying? I probably should just start doing it, but this smaller group, it probably doesn't matter. Okay, hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? All right, sounds good. I will greet people in the Cloud Zendo, and then those in the Dirt Zendo will introduce themselves. Start with Karen.
Karen.
Betty.
Betty.
Yeshaytsoki.
Yeshaytsoki.
Bob.
Bob.
Paul.
Paul.
Tyler.
Tyler.
With your spanky new Wagessa on. Marv.
Marv.
Dave Brown.
Dave Brown.
Mary.
Mary.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Mick.
Mick.
Phil.
Phil.
Dennis.
Dennis.
Another spanky Wagessa. Marianne.
Marianne.
Coral and Carson.
Coral and Carson.
Drew.
Drew.
Sabrina.
Sabrina.
And Ruth Ann.
Ruth Ann.
And in the Dirt Zendo.
Mark.
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 Andrew.
Andrew.
Joan.
Joan.
Erica.
Erica.
Dave.
Dave. Domio.
Domio.
All right. So congrats to the 10 people who formally became Buddhist on Sunday. And let's see. In terms of announcements, there will be, I am leading the class tonight, and then really our Sangha Voices series starts a little, we have a little preview next Tuesday. I will be visiting family in Minneapolis. So Tyler will be leading the class. And then I will come back and do another couple classes. And then in July, I'll be on sabbatical, and others will be stepping forward to lead the Tuesdays and Sundays. So please attend and get to know your Sangha members better. It's very different people. Some people will be giving way-seeking mind talks. Some people will be speaking on topics that have been of interest to them. So please attend. Also, I think a newsletter or a email announcement went out today about a new thing that we have on our website, which is full Tuesday, Saturday, and Sunday schedules translated for your time zone. If you are not in Pacific time zone, then you can print these schedules out, and it's complete from like, this is when it begins, this is when chanting is, this is when Zazen is, this is when Kenyan is, all that translated. And it's really fascinating if you go to that page on the website and just pull up some of these schedules for people who join us from these other time zones, like Ken, who joins up from Hawaii sometimes, and I'm looking like, dang, that is early on a Sunday when he joins us. And you know, folks from the UK who join us, and you'll see like how different the schedule is for them. So it's kind of interesting to look at. I think that's all I can think of. Oh no. There is, I think it's July 9th. So I will be on sabbatical, but we will have a local picnic, a Sangha picnic. So stay tuned for that. It'll be announced in the newsletter, and it'll be on our calendar. And then we haven't gotten the announcement out about this yet, but I think it's a Saturday, August 6th, I think it is. It's like the first Saturday in August, and we will have a Sangha open mic night. So there will be folks in the Dirt Zendo sharing things, and folks in the Cloud Zendo sharing things, and James is going to be our MC and coordinator, so we it should be a fun time getting to, and there's basically, that's how we left it, like, it's not a talent show, it's not a no talent show, it's just a time to share, so be thinking about that. Any questions about any of that or anything else I should announce?
Is the Sangha open mic night just for the Sangha, or can spouses come?
I would encourage other people to come. Yeah. And I think, you know, the Sangha member, like, it should be the Sangha member sharing. But if you need friends and family to, like, help with your sharing, that certainly would be fine. All right. Yeah, that would be great if other, you know, friends and family wanted to watch and participate. I think it's that kind of thing, like picnics. We used to have a real habit of potlucks, and these kinds of things are really great for inviting your family or friends along so that they know Buddhists aren't really weird, that they're just normal people, and that's a good thing. All right.
Domio?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm just curious. Are we planning on having any retreats or session one days on a weekend before next March?
Yes, and I think they are already on the calendar. There should be, I think, at least two of them. So there'll be a term student retreat in the fall, and then there'll be two just regular one-day retreats. So I forget their dates, though, but I think they're like September.
How about before the fall? I was thinking actually more before the fall, because I've had a couple of folks ask me, when is our next retreat? And I thought, and they said, because they'd like to fly in. So it's like,
they'd like to fly in for a one-day retreat?
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it's a mini vacation. It's summertime. It's good weather. Flying in November would be a little chancy for some folks. Just asking.
Yeah. I think I probably should have said, you know, I think it was our April, whenever the last time we had our one-day retreat, I think I probably should have announced to people, this is the last one before the fall, because I think we were about eight people, you know, like about four of us in the Zendo or something. So, yeah, I'll have to whip them up a little better. Oh, thank you, Dennis. You shared a link to the days for our online retreats, or our one-day retreats. All right, so tonight I want to talk about studying the self. And then there will be two more classes on this. And I'm sure then I'll have it completely just, you know, sewed up and you don't need to know anything more. Saying that sarcastically. So as many of you know, in Genjo Koan, the writing by Dogen that we often recite on Tuesdays and often study in Soto Zen, he says, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. And if you're curious, that is in the chant book, because we have Genjo Koan is in the chant book as one of our Tuesday chants. So as we know, or at least we hear in Buddhism, the true nature of the self is empty. It's ungraspable and illusory, and self-concern in the form of, we say, I, me, and my making, all the things about, like, I do this, this is done to me, and these are all my things, my relationships. All of that self-concern is the center of our stress, our suffering, our harmful behavior, difficult relationships with others, you name it. So we aim to let go of self-concern. You know, we train ourselves in our precept work, for instance, and we aim to awaken to a direct experience of the nature of self as empty. And then we're never quite as mesmerized by it again once we have that direct personal understanding. So we work on it in these two ways. We work on the self to try to be less self-concerned, and we also try to work on our insight into the emptiness of self, because it really shifts our whole relationship to it. So we call these two sides of practice karma relationship and samadhi power, or you might call them, you know, behavior and insight, and both are important and interdependent. So this, what I want to talk about in the next three classes that I'm going to do, is to focus on that first step in Dogen's path. So not so much, to forgetting the self, a little bit of forgetting, how this leads into forgetting the self we'll talk about, but, you know, forgetting the self and verified by all things and all that, we're not going to get there. Sometimes we think Buddhism is asking us to jump directly to that second step of forgetting the self. But that's actually impossible. Or if we seem to do it, we've usually jumped over a bunch of work we need to do. And we're, you know, spiritually bypassing or something. In order to transcend our small sense of self, we have to become intimately familiar with and radically accept who we are, including our karma, our behavior, our personality, our tendencies, habits, desires, fears. If we don't clearly see the self, we don't know how to let go of it. We don't know what we're supposed to let go of. We don't know what we're supposed to transcend. But what does it mean to study the self? We start out with the premise that there is no independent, enduring, graspable self-nature. So what is it we're studying? This isn't about, you know, finding some true you, finding out who you really are, or crafting some master narrative about yourself that will answer all questions and complete all stories. We actually have to be careful when studying the self not to further reify it. What we are is a collection of skandhas, as the Buddha taught from the beginning. So skandha just means aggregate or heap. So the human being is described as being composed of these skandhas. And their form, or our physical form, sensation, you know, just direct sensations on our, you know, of hot and cold and water and whatever, light. And then perception, which is where the brain, you know, makes the connection between this information coming in and it, you know, might name it or respond to it. And then mental formations, our thoughts, our volition, all of the mental activity, and then consciousness, which is this sense of ourselves and this sense of a being over time. So these are this is what we're composed of. So I wanted to share with you, just in case you aren't familiar with it, one of my very favorite relevant Buddhist texts about this. So this isn't the whole text, but just a part of it. And I'm going to read it. It's read a good page of it because I want to, you know, for you to enjoy the story. So this is from called The Questions of King Milinda, or the Milinda Panha. And this is the translation by Edward Konza. So Nagasena is a Buddhist teacher, and this King Milinda has come to learn from him and ask him questions. So King Milinda asked him, "How is your reverence known? What is your name, sir?" "As Nagasena, I am known, O great king. And as Nagasena do my fellow religious habitually address me. But although parents give names such as Nagasena or Surasena or Virasena or Sihasena, nevertheless, this word Nagasena is just a denomination, a designation, a conceptual term, a current appellation, a mere name. For no real person here can be apprehended." But King Milinda exclaimed, "Now listen, you 500 Greeks and 80,000 monks. This Nagasena tells me that he is not a real person. How can I be expected to agree with that?" And to Nagasena he said, "If, most reverend Nagasena, no person can be apprehended in reality, who then, I ask you, gives you what you require by way of robes, food, lodging, and medicines? Who is it that guards morality, practices meditation, and realizes the four paths and their fruits, and thereafter nirvana? Who is it that kills living beings, takes what is not given, commits sexual misconduct, tells lies, drinks intoxicants? Who is it that commits the five deadly sins? For if there were no person, there could be no merit and no demerit, no doer of meritorious or demeritorious deeds, no agent behind them, no fruit of good and evil deeds, no reward or punishment for them. You just told me that your fellow religious habitually address you as Nagasena. Then what is Nagasena? Perhaps the hairs of the head? No, great king. Or perhaps the nails, teeth, skin, muscles, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, serous membrane, spleen, lungs, intestine, mesentery, stomach, excrement, the bile, phlegm, pus, blood, grease, fat, tears, sweat, spittle, snot, fluid of the joints, urine, or the brain in the skull? Are they this Nagasena? No, great king. Is Nagasena a form or feelings or perceptions or impulses or consciousness? No, great king. Then it is the combination of form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness? No, great king. Then it is it outside the combination of form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness? No, great king. Then ask as I may, I can discover no Nagasena at all. This Nagasena is a mere sound, and who is the real Nagasena? Your reverence has told a lie, has spoken a falsehood. There is really no Nagasena. Thereupon, the venerable Nagasena said to King Milinda, "As a king, you have been brought up in great refinement, and you avoid roughness of any kind. If you would walk at midday on this hot, burning, and sandy ground, then your feet would have to tread on the rough and gritty gravel and pebbles, and they would hurt you. Your body would get tired, your mind impaired, and your awareness of your body would be associated with pain. How then did you come? On foot or on a mount?" "I did not come, sir, on foot, but on a chariot." "If you have come on a chariot, then please explain to me what a chariot is. Is the pole the chariot?" "No, reverend sir." "Is the axle the chariot?" "No, reverend sir." Is it then the wheels, or the framework, or the flagstaff? The yoke, the reins, or the goadstick? No, reverend sir. Then it is it the combination of yoke, axle, wheels, framework, flagstaff, reins, and goad, which is the chariot? And when I think about this, I think of all those things just like piled up in a heap. Would that be a chariot? No. Then is this chariot outside the combination of these things? No, reverend sir. Then ask as I may, I can discover no chariot at all. This chariot is just a mere sound. But what is the real chariot? Your majesty has told a lie, has spoken a falsehood. There really is no chariot. Your majesty is the greatest king in the whole of India. Of whom then are you afraid that you do not speak the truth? And he exclaimed, "Now listen, you 500 Greeks and 80,000 monks. This King Milinda tells me he has come on a chariot. But when asked to explain to me what a chariot is, he cannot establish its existence. How can one possibly approve of that?" The 500 Greeks thereupon applauded the venerable Nagasena and said to King Milinda, "Now let your majesty get out of that one if you can." But King Milinda said to Nagasena, "I have not, Nagasena, spoken a falsehood. For it is independence on the pole, the axle, the wheels, the framework, the flagstaff, etc. There takes place this denomination, chariot, this designation, this conceptual term, a current appellation, and a mere name. Your majesty has spoken well about the chariot. It is just so with me. Independence on the 32 parts of the body and the 5 skandhas, there takes place this denomination, Nagasena, this designation, this conceptual term, a current appellation, and a mere name. In ultimate reality, however, this person cannot be apprehended." So, this self phenomenon of ours, this collection of stuff, which is everything you identify as I, me, or mine, our body, our sensations, our perceptions, our thoughts, our emotions, and then extending out from there, our relationships, our roles, possessions, our experiences, our memories, our opinions, our impulses, our desires, our values, all of it. The whole heap of it, which there's no real fixed boundaries to this sense of ourselves. All of this collection of stuff. This is our vehicle for practice, for enlightenment, for bodhisattva activity. So, as we say, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. Like, Buddhas are sentient beings who have woken up. So if we didn't have this predicament of being human beings, Buddhahood would be irrelevant. This is about being in our predicament and being liberated from delusion. All of this is describing what we can become, Buddha, enlightenment, liberation, when we realize our true nature and act in accord with it, instead of dreaming up and defending a fixed self, illusory fixed self. Therefore, as we engage this practice, our stuff, all of this stuff, is not an impurity to be gotten rid of. It's not a sad compromise to transcend. This very body is the body of Buddha. So we're not going to understand Buddha until we know this body and mind. But what do we mean by studying and knowing? There are different ways to do this. In the case of the self, we are not looking for fixed knowing. Now, there's different kinds of knowing and perceiving and whatever. So knowing usually what we mean is like, okay, we know something. Now we don't really have to think on that topic anymore. We have a fixed answer or a, you know, an idea about it, a way to respond to it. We just, you know, we don't have to deal with it anymore. We know. Yeah, I know that. Listen, I hear a bird. If it's a robin, yeah, I know. That's a robin. Okay, we're done with that. So we don't have to deal with reality anymore because we know something. And that's definitely not the kind of knowing that we're seeking to do for ourselves, to know stuff about ourselves in that sense. Instead, we get familiar with the self. So Shohaku Okumura, in Realizing Genjo Koan, he says that the Japanese word translated to study is called nirau, which means to get accustomed to or to become familiar with. In other words, to become familiar with the Buddha way is to become familiar with the self. Or maybe to learn. To learn the Buddha way is to learn the self. So as we become, through practice, more and more familiar with the self, and we have many different ways of doing this. We have our Zazen practice, we have our precept practice, we have Sangha interactions, we have all these different ways that are meant to, you know, I feel like that's one of the things that we do when we go away to Sesshin, to a residential retreat, is we're putting ourselves in this weird situation. It's like, you know, a little bit like somebody, you know, maybe when you go traveling or something and you're deliberately putting yourself in a very different foreign environment, in part to learn about yourself. So what's going to happen? How am I going to respond? How is my experience of this going to be? So that's, we do many things in practice that are meant to be helping us get to know ourselves better. And so as we do this, we end up moving further on both of our intentions. That's working on our behavior or karma to act less self-centeredly, because, you know, like, probably the most harmful things that we do are things that we aren't even conscious of, right? We aren't even aware of biases or limitations or whatever. And as we become more familiar with them, ways to work with them and perhaps let them go sometimes open up. So as we become more familiar with the self, we're also working toward that insight into the emptiness of self. Because the more familiar we become with the self, the more we realize we aren't who we thought we were. And that anything that we become familiar with changes. It's not graspable. We can never grasp who we are with our minds, despite our karmic despite our karma and tendencies, undeniable tendencies. No narrative fits. I had an image during Zazen of like the self is really more like a flock of birds. Like, it has characteristics, it hangs together, it has habits. You could become familiar with this flock of birds, but it's not something that you can, like, you know, fix and stop or find the essence of. In the process of becoming more familiar with the self, we pretty much inevitably need to face things we may not want to face. We need to explore our issues in a deliberate way, maybe sometimes with counseling or other direct investigative means. We probably need, and this is something I want to talk about in subsequent classes, we probably need a fair amount of healing, of recognizing the injured parts of ourselves and radically accepting them and trying to get them what they need. This forgetting the self can't, it's it can't happen in the way we want it to, that is, in a transcendent way, unless the self is in decent shape. unless, you know, we've healed some of our trauma and forgiven ourselves or forgiven others or, you know, whatever it is, that heavy, twisted karma that we're carrying, we can't skip over dealing with it. But, you know, you can't really let it go until you know what it is. So this is a long and lifelong process. But over time, we can strengthen what you might think of as our intrapersonal intelligence. My husband hates the whole idea that there's multiple intelligences, but, you know, whatever, it's just a matter of words. But the idea being that there's, you know, there's logical, mathematical intelligence, whether you just call it a strength or aptitude. There's bodily and kinesthetic intelligence, musical, naturalist, linguistic, spatial, interpersonal, and then intrapersonal is about, which is something that we can work on, is being able to perceive, reflect on, analyze, interpret, understand, and predict your own internal experience. Really getting to know yourself, including your thoughts and emotions and mind states, your reactions, your impulses, your fears and desires. We must become fascinated with ourselves. At the same time, we try to remember that while we are unique, that it's not uniqueness we're going for here. So it's not a fascination with myself because I am so much more interesting than anyone else, or worse or better or anything, but just I am me, right? I can only be fascinated by myself in this way, in this internal way. And you can only be fascinated by yourself in that internal way. So we must become fascinated with ourselves, with being a self. And over time, we end up realizing more and more how we really are like everybody else. Yeah, I mean, we get to know our quirks and our strengths and limitations and whatever. And I think, you know, you're probably familiar. If somebody knows themselves pretty well, they can say something like, yeah, I'm happy to do that. You know, chances are I'm going to get a little stressed and you're going to have to remind me, you know, whatever. Like, people can manage themselves and help them do that because they know themselves. So we become fascinated by that. But we realize that we're really just like everybody else in the sense that the Buddhist teachings and practices, the teachings of the ancestors, really do apply to us, just as if they knew us. They don't really have to know us, right? Like, at a fundamental level, we're all pretty the same. Like, we're all just, we want to be loved and accepted, and we're afraid of death, and, you know, we want to be safe and comfortable, and, you know, it just kind of comes down to that. We have different, you know, narratives around that, but fundamentally, we're pretty similar. This also isn't about coming up with a list of strengths and weaknesses, proclivities and preferences, and just ending it there. We really want to understand ourselves, to become really familiar with ourselves down to our bones, not just create a superficial description we can offer to explain our behavior. Oh, well, you know, I fly off the handle sometimes. I mean, that might be a relevant thing to say, but we explore more. Why do you fly off the handle sometimes? What is that about? What is playing out in your mind and body? Where does that come from? What causes it to arise? Why do we do what we do? Why do we feel, think, or say certain things? What fear is behind our reactivity or anxiety? What's underneath our fears and longings? So with practice, we learn to reflect on ourselves through the day, every day. All of our moods and responses and experiences. Taking everything, particularly negative things, as opportunities to get more familiar with ourselves. Oh, that's an interesting reaction. So once that familiarity is deep enough, our self-attachment starts to dissipate, and we start to get close to an understanding of the emptiness of self. So if you're curious about, like, in some senses, when I talk about this, people will be like, well, how does this happen? When does this happen? When does this self-study happen? And the thing is, the early Buddhists were very, very, very explicit about this, very explicit and methodical. And it's not clear from what the Buddha taught when he talks about mindfulness, about whether this you're always in the meditation posture when you do this, or like at other times. Because in Zen, because in Soto Zen, we have this practice of shikantaza, which is not sitting there analyzing the self, right? So we keep that kind of sacred. That is not the time for this kind of self-study, unless it just arises. Sometimes, one of our readings is something like bright clarity appears before you. Sometimes it's just like there in front of you. You're not analyzing, you're not looking for it. Just insight into yourself arises. And that's fine. So we're although there's nothing wrong with sitting in the meditation cushion doing something other than shikantaza if you are choosing to do that. So the kind of mindfulness that I'm going to talk about can happen on the cushion, or for me, a lot of it just happens wandering around throughout the day, you know, having a quiet moment after an interaction with people, or I've had some thoughts, or I notice a mood is going on, or something like that, to really reflect on what's going on. So just to share briefly, I imagine some of you are familiar with the four foundations of mindfulness, which is from in the original Buddhist teachings. And it's very, you know, takes you through these steps. So first of all, and you don't necessarily have to do these in order, but the idea is that we start with what is simple and move into what is more complex. So we start with mindfulness of the body. And here's his description of it. And how does a monk remain focused on the body in and of itself? Breathing in long, he discerns, I am breathing in long. Or breathing out long, he discerns, I am breathing out long. Or breathing in short, she discerns, I am breathing in short. Or breathing out short, she discerns, I am breathing out short. He trains himself, I will breathe in sensitivity to the whole body. And further, when walking, the monk discerns, I am walking. When standing, she discerns, I am standing. When sitting, he discerns, I am sitting. When lying down, she discerns, I am lying down. Or however his body is disposed, that is how he discerns it. So there's just this, you know, building this awareness of our movements, of our body, of our sensations throughout our day. And you'll notice and sometimes people are naturally like this. Others of us really have to work on it through practice. But you'll notice people who are, it's just very sweet to be in an environment with fellow practitioners, because people are, generally speaking, more mindful, more aware of what's happening. They're aware that they dropped a wrapper. They're aware that they, you know, there's something that needs to be picked up over there. They're aware that somebody's coming in the door behind them. They're just more more present. So moving on from the body, then there's feelings. So feelings are not, in the Buddhist sense, they're not complex emotions. They're just the feelings of like, of attraction, yes, aversion, I don't like that, or kind of indifference or neutrality. Like, so this is like a very basic animal response, right? Yes, you can move toward that thing. Ooh, I don't like that thing, or that's irrelevant to me. And how does a monk remain focused on feelings in and of themselves? There is the case when a monk, when feeling a painful feeling, discerns, I am feeling a painful feeling. When feeling a pleasant feeling, she discerns, I am feeling a pleasant feeling. When feeling a neither pleasant nor painful feeling, he discerns, I am feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So there's a kind of, I like to think in this study of the self that we are taking the attitude of a scientist, a kind of objective, curious, that's interesting. I am experiencing feelings of rage right now. And just noticing, not, because if you were a scientist trying to understand, you wouldn't go in and interfere, right? You wouldn't go in and try to mess with it or stop it. You would just be noticing, because if otherwise you're gonna, you won't be able to become familiar with this, the true habits and nature of what you're observing. Then we practice mindfulness of the mind, which are really, this gets more complicated. You notice the mind has passion, or the mind is without passion, or the mind is experiencing aversion, or the mind is experiencing delusion, or, and there's a whole set of other things, the mind is constricted or scattered or enlarged, surpassed, concentrated, or released. And each of them has a specific meaning. So as we study, we can learn to discern more of our different mind states. And then finally, the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the Dhamma, or mental qualities. So this is kind of a weird category. It's just like, to me, I just think it's like, now we go on to mindful contemplation of the Buddhist teachings as they are reflected in our direct experience. So, you know, we start off by noticing the presence or absence of the five hindrances within us: sensual desire, ill will, sloth, restlessness, and doubt. And we begin to, we particularly contemplate with mindfulness the ephemeral nature of the five aggregates, of the skandhas. So we start to really pay attention to, like, that thought arises and then it passes away. Or a big one for me has been like, this emotion arises, like, oh, I'm so angry, or this has to happen. And then, like, you know, later on, it's gone. So what, you begin to recognize the unreality of these things. And then the presence or absence of the seven factors of awakening within you: mindfulness, persistence, rapture, calm, concentration, and equanimity. And then finally, the Four Noble Truths: the arising of dukkha, seeing where that dukkha comes from, releasing the resistance or the desire that is causing the dukkha, and then, you know, experiencing the resultant peace. So I bring that up, all of that up, not because I'm saying that you should memorize it or necessarily use that methodology, although if you want to, if you're somebody who's like, come on, give me some steps, give me some instructions, Then, but by all means, go to the Satipatthana Sutta and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I tend to like Zen because it's a little more like kind of free form, you know, a little more like jazz. So you just get you take the spirit of this and then try to, you know, work on it in your daily life, reflecting on, try more and more carefully. And sometimes it really helps having discussions with Sangha members or having a discussion with a teacher to learn how to reflect on your experiences and delve into them more. And I think it's interesting that, I mean, some of this similar kind of thing you might end up doing in therapy, but I think maybe the ultimate goal is different. Where the ultimate goal, you know, therapy is generally like a healthy functioning self, so you know you can get out there and have a decent life, which is great, but that's almost like, okay, now let's do the Zen practice, right? Now that you have a nice, healthy, functioning self, now let us teach you how that's empty. So that, you know, we always have this emptiness on the horizon. So, yeah. I know that was just kind of a lot, but take some questions and comments about studying the self. So just to say next time I'll go a little bit more into, so this is a little bit like kind of what do we mean by studying the self, and then hopefully in the next couple classes we'll get more into how might this actually look? How might we actually do this, start on this process? So any questions or comments in the Dirt Zendo or Cloud Zendo?
I guess partly just so I can understand the scope of it all. Is this something that you do your whole life?
Yes. And I'm glad you asked that question. It is, but there are, I would say, there's rewarding progress can be made. So in a sense, like we're never done. We're never ever done. And even most of us would think like, I know myself pretty well. I'm okay. You know, something may come up in our lives that shows us, oh, geez, I wasn't ready for that. You know, so it, but I felt like the first, I don't know, the first 5 to 10 years of practice, it felt like I had a closet full of skeletons. And like, I was constantly, you know, all right, discovering another one and having to drag it out into the light. And, really? Oh, God, you know. So a kind of a surprise, or I didn't know it was that bad, or it, and I do feel like at a certain point, like I'm pretty, there may be some skeletons still in there, but I kind of know that they're there. It's not a complete surprise. So it's not like, you know, you reach perfection, but you reach a level of knowledge and comfort that, most of us, I think, without practice, get to a certain level of, you know, we can function. It's not, like the skeletons aren't causing a big problem in our lives. But with practice, we're saying, you know, pulling them out and wrestling with them, it's a weird metaphor, but is instructive. Like, this is an opportunity to study the self and thereby forget the self. So we're not, it's not a matter that we're just like, we have this self-improvement project and we're constantly trying to get closer to perfection. Although I guess, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But more that as long as there is still reactivity and fear and inhibition or any of the things that most of us still have, there's still a koan there. And that that is where we go if we want more ease and more liberation and more insight. Does that make sense? So it sounds like just recognizing and using the system, so to speak, or just, you know, going through that process, becoming familiar with being aware and going through that process is really helpful. And that just becomes part of your life almost, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Mick?
Now you can put it on speaker view.
Yeah, so I have a question about this kind of thing.
I can't hear you, Mick.
We can hear him.
Everybody else can hear him?
Online we can.
Where's your audio coming from?
Join audio on the cart.
No. We should be hearing their audio through.
Just a little bit. It just sounds like it's like the volume.
Sorry,
like,
what? We can't join audio over there. We can only join audio in one place. There's something up with our speaker here.
How about it now?
Aha! I don't think it was you. I think it was us. All right, we can hear you now.
That's great. Okay, so I guess I have a question about this, like, examining the self and when it arises, because, you know, in practice, like, I kind of already know the answer, and the answer is that, like, that's not really me, you know. It's really hard, like, I don't want to ask if I'm doing it wrong, but am I doing it wrong if I'm like examining what I'm doing and I'm already have the answer in the back of my mind that, like, that's not really it? Does that make sense? Am I affecting my ability to just perceive what arises when I'm already kind of dismissing it as not real?
You know, probably, if you're asking that question, probably a little. Like, I think it's helpful when we're contemplating some of this stuff to at least keep in the background, you know, this reminder, like, all right, you know, it's not, don't take it too seriously. It's not, there is no inherent you, right? That's a little comforting. But yeah, I do think it's very easy to dismiss our experiences, you know, that, I guess I was surprised by how this process of getting familiar with the self and then actually being able to let go and, you know, actually be able to believe I too had a Buddha nature, and, you know, that kind of liberation was so, so personal. It was not in any way like, wow, transcendent view that I got during Zazen of how wacky the universe is. It was like, me? You mean me? I mean, it, me with my, you know, my anger and my desire and my, just this, me. So it's like, we got to take all this with us. Now we can't grasp it. It's, you know, there's no inherent essence in it, and yet it's everything that we have. It is our vehicle. And yeah, so I think that kind of, you know, there's all kinds of wisdom being added to Buddhism, I think, by modern psychology, because I suspect people always had to do this work, but Buddhism isn't all that explanatory about it. And either it didn't need to be, I don't know, maybe we're more screwed up than our ancestors, maybe, but I suspect not. But I love how modern psychology, it can be very, very deliberate and thoughtful about this, and reparenting and radical acceptance and all of this stuff that we recognize, you know, is very positive and needs to happen. So, yeah, it's easy to dismiss because we know it's all empty. Dave.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
That worked. Mick, you were a pathfinder there. I'd have been talking to myself. I just have a quick question. When you're talking about the self, I'm assuming all through this talk, you're talking about the small self, not the Buddha self, the small self that we kind of create for ourselves. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but I think maybe I'm talking about something that, I mean, when you really start to try to define self, is kind of crazy making, even just a dictionary definition. I think the self that I'm talking about here, it's not, so a lot of times when I think small self, I'm thinking like our small sense of self, you know, our self-concern. So that's something a little bit more specific, where I'm kind of like, I don't know, the five aggregate self, the self that's like a collection of stuff, which includes that, you know, small sense of self and I, me, and mine, but also includes just, you know, karma and relationships and possessions and I don't know. So it's that whole heap of stuff.
Where I was going with this, if you're studying the non-Buddha self, then it's mutable and constantly changing, I feel. So would it be more productive to study, rather than the self, which is a moving target, the reason you created the self, how you created the self imperfectly and why you did it, as opposed to studying this moving target? You know, I'm an asshole in these situations because, and it's the because, how, why that you would study, rather than just being an asshole in these situations and asking questions all the time.
Yeah, because I think the problematic and therefore the instructive parts of this heap of self, at the root of it is that small sense of self, right? That protecting I, me, and mine, and looking out for that, and has the fear and the sense of inadequacy or whatever it is. So yeah, indeed, like we're under the heap is this small sense of self that has collected all this stuff, like a big one of those snails that collects stuff to, you know, decorate its shell. So yeah, definitely, like in the process of becoming familiar with the self, we definitely see that. So it's 9 o'clock, but I did want to suggest something as homework for next time. And some of you may love this and some of you may hate it. It's obviously completely optional. You have 2 weeks because Tyler will talk about something else next week. As a fun, hopefully fun, thought-provoking tool for doing a little self-study, I was going to suggest that you take the Enneagram test. I don't know, some of you may be familiar with it, some may not. It's a personality test, you know, and all personality schemes are, to some extent, BS. You know, is there just somebody just made them up? But, you know, there are tendencies and karma that tends to, you know, kind of, I don't know, coagulate is the right word, but, you know, it tends to kind of come together. And I have found myself the Enneagram to be a very useful tool for, you know, it gets you thinking. Even if you don't really think that you end up, you know, being correctly categorized in one of the 9 personality types or something. One of the cool things about it is that it really presents it in a spiritual context where a personality type is described as having, like, when it is essentially unenlightened, this is how it manifests. And then when, you know, with practice, this is how it can manifest. So that's one of the things I really love about it, where sometimes the weaknesses or proclivities or fears or whatever that we have, they're not inherently bad. It's if we can work with them and heal them, they actually can become our strengths. So anyway, they're on the website, on the Bright Ways End website under Tuesday Study. I did add some links, just saying if you want to take this test, there's at the Enneagram Institute, there's one that you can pay $12 to take, which is better than the free ones. But there are some free ones, and there's even one that you don't have to even give your email in order to get the results. I took a few of them this afternoon, the free ones, just to see what they were like. And they can be a little annoying. You know, you're kind of like, what that? I can't answer that. You know, that neither answer fits or whatever. But you're supposed to just kind of, you know, answer your gut feeling and not editing like how you think you should be. And perhaps also how you used to be. Maybe before practice, you know, when in your raw form, what were your tendencies and proclivities? And then if you take the test and, you know, it gives you a result, I really recommend reading a description of the different types, particularly the one that the test thinks you are. And if it doesn't seem right, that just disregard the results of the tests. Sometimes it's like the tests aren't quite right and you recognize who you are. And I should warn you, if you are an Enneagram type 6, when you take these tests, it's going to look like you are evenly divided amongst 4 or 5 different types. And it took me a while to learn that, like, oh, well, that means you're a 6. Although if that happens and you read the 6 and it doesn't sound like you, then maybe you just need to take a different test. But what is sweet is that my teachers did this actually with the Myers-Briggs at Dharma Rain, and which I like Enneagram better. It kind of just like, it gives you some language and to talk about, and it might be kind of fun next week and like, yeah, I got this type, but I didn't think I was that type. But it gets you thinking about these different aspects of our karma and personality and whatever. So whether you like it or you hate it, it'll get you thinking. So, yeah, go ahead and give that a try. And in the meantime, I will see you all later. Thank you all for being here. Oh, let me see the closing verse. Sorry. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna, Parita.
Thank you.
Thank you, Damiel.